Welcome back to the War Room. I'm joined by Karsten once again here to break down round three of Supercross. And I don't know how to think. I mean, really how to think about this Supercross season, dude. It feels like the more we race, the less we find out, the less we know. And I still don't have a great grasp on who is going to kind of rise to the top from the cream here, or who's going to be the cream that rises to the top, for, you know, failed analogy there. But we keep racing. We keep getting more rain. Second mud race in a row. At least it kind of dried up a little bit for the main events. And a very special American, I would rather say the most American rider on the grid, and maybe possibly in the entire sport itself's history. Aaron Plessinger, the Cowboy, finally gets it done. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to say finally as if we were like just waiting for, you know, an eternity, although he has been in the 450 class for like 4 years, but like, man, I was super excited, dude. The only thing that could have made me more excited was if Malcolm won, and I don't know if that's coming anytime soon until he breaks whatever curse is put on him. We'll talk about that later. And like I said, especially the 450s, I mean, it just keeps going back and forth, dude. And but exciting races all around. What are we talking about first?
Yeah, let's talk about AP, man. I mean, an incredible race. I think it feels like it's finally, because he's been so close so many times, and he's, you know, he's done well in qualifying, he's done well in heat races, like he's been right there, and he's been a top five guy for a while. And so when he's sitting there as a top five guy and he hasn't gotten a win yet, it's like, okay, when's it gonna happen? And you know, it's not even like things had to necessarily go wrong for other people, because he has been there so close. Like, but he's had great speed this season, and yeah, I mean, he's done awesome. So I think, yeah, it is a finally thing, but it doesn't seem like it was a fluke. Like, I think he's going to be here to stay.
Well, and I think if it would have happened in San Francisco with that kind of mutter, I think people would have been like, okay, well, he got the win, but it was a one-off because it was a mutter. But that the condition of that track in the main event was fairly dry. It wasn't like anywhere near San Francisco. It was just, hey, we've got some deep ruts. Basically, the track in a lot of places is one line. And, you know, it's still a little, in the places where those ruts aren't dug into the ground and you got more of that dry stuff, it is more slippery. So in certain areas, you know, hey, if you take this line, you ain't going to be able to get that double. You're going to case it, you know. It as we'll talk about later, there were certain riders taking advantage of that and, you know, almost capitalizing on the, in, you know, unraceability of certain areas of the track. And that led to some little post-race scuffles, little tussles, you know, just little get after it, you know?
Some kerfuffles, yes, we had that.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Good for the sport, honestly, and we'll get into that later. But yeah, look, Aaron had a fantastic ride, and there was no ifs, ands, or buts, or someone, you know, he got lucky, it wasn't a crazy mutter like San Francisco. He legitimately came out there and opened up a can on these guys, mm-hmm. And the other thing is, here's two crazy stats for you that paint the picture of just how much better AP's been racing this season, okay? There are only two riders in this entire 450 Supercross class at the time of race three who have not been lapped, and that is Dylan Ferrandis and Aaron Plessinger. Now, the second part, Aaron Plessinger is the only 450 Supercross rider that has finished top five in all three races thus far. So that paints the picture of just how wild of a season we're having thus far. And also it just paints the picture of how inconsistent of a season we're having thus far in regards to the field as a whole, because you think of all the guys that have gotten lapped. I mean, names that are not included in Plessinger Ferrandis include Eli Tomac, Jet Lawrence, Chase Sexton, Cooper Webb, Ken Roczen, Malcolm Stewart,
Chase everyone Gannon, else.
And just so many other guys. Yeah. That just the names are like, okay, why are these guys getting lapped? You know?
Well, it's like, so with, you know, Cooper's coming around. It's like, oh, Cooper's having trouble with lappers. Who's the lapper? Chase Sexton. It's like, what?
Why?
What?
How?
Yeah, that doesn't, you know, usually it's like, oh, he's having trouble getting around Chase Sexton because it's for the lead or for second or for third, not for 10th place and he's being lapped. So yeah, very, very interesting. And I mean, I guess AP and Ferrandis, consistency kings.
Yeah.
They're the consistent consistency kings, bro.
100%, dude. And yeah, I think Ferrandis has been like a fourth, fifth, and then he was sixth last time. What was he? Yeah, he was sixth last race. So, I mean, pretty much averaging a top five. And I mean, for him being on a new team with that firepower Honda that he keeps saying is fantastic and has never praised the bike as much as he has right now, it's really funny because his first three races last year are pretty similar results, but he just feels so much better. Now, granted, this field's also a little bit deeper than it was last year.
Yeah.
So there is that to take into account. But still, it's so funny how the picture is so differently painted when he's getting very similar results to what he did last year on the Yamaha. But he was absolutely just, you know, giving that, you know, dog in that bike, saying there was all kinds of problems with it. Never felt comfortable. Super unhappy. You know, very French of him, you know. But anywho.
Well, and I mean, like you were saying, though, like we don't have a great gauge on it because we've had two irregular, although it is the majority of the races have been mutters. Mm-hmm. So I guess, yep. I guess they're not, it's and not irregular only, at this point, but that's an irregular.
And the only non-mutter is Anaheim 1. Yeah. So, and like Anaheim 1, it's always like, oh, you can't take all your homework from Anaheim 1 and write a book on it because heck, there was almost a decade long curse of if you won Anaheim 1, you were not going to win the championship, started by Ryan Villopoto in 2014, I believe. And it's, you know, there's so, I mean, think of all the guys that have won Anaheim 1 the last couple of years, you know, a lot of them have not gone on to win the championship because of just the inconsistencies of Anaheim 1, guys that are still trying to figure out the setup on their bikes. The nerves, it's just a different race. So for that to be your only dry race, and then you have these two, you know, one an absolute, I refer to it as, you know, Taco Bell post-digestion track status or track condition of a mutter. And then the other one, this one was more like, you know, a chocolate smoothie king kind of deal for the heat races. And then it kind of just, it dried out for the main, for the most part.
We're getting some lines, a little more solid, you know. A little more balanced diet on this one. Maybe next one will, you know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, our stomach was really upset in San Francisco. And then San Diego, we were like on the road to recovery. So then maybe by the time we get to Anaheim 2, it'll be all coming out dry. We'll be good.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, we'll see. What do you think about – I think that AP choosing to wear the same gear as Detroit – where he had the incident, we went to the rut, foot comes off. He goes, I forgot how bad that crash was. I rewatched it and it looks really bad. Like it's surprising that he was pretty much okay and his bike was
really kind of messed up. Well, he couldn't race in Seattle the next weekend. Last minute, he thought he was going to be able to, but just couldn't recover in time because he hit his ribs.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was. So like he was able to bounce back within 2 weeks, but yeah, no, it was way worse than everyone thought.
Yeah.
But he just landed it. Like he landed, I think his ribs hit the beginning of the next tabletop. So
yeah,
it was just bad.
Not a good crash. And obviously any crash, you know, you don't want to do that, but
no,
choosing to wear the same gear. I feel like this is a scenario where the gear is retired. No matter the outcome.
I don't know what to do. And the crazy part is I listened to he was on the Pulp MX show Monday or Tuesday or something like that. And everyone thought, hey, why'd you pick that? You know, well, then you think it was cursed. He's like, well, the funny thing is I didn't. KTM picks all of our gear. And
oh, wow.
He just saw that laid out for him at the start of the race and was like PTSD flashback.
Yeah.
So I couldn't imagine the look on his face when he was like, oh, no. But I think he almost was like, I don't know if he still realized it at first until he told the guys. He was like, isn't this what I wore at Detroit, Detroit? And they were like, hold on, let's pull up that viral video of you crashing real quick. Oh, yep, it is. Well, too late. Yeah. Don't have anything else to wear. Good luck.
Yeah, because, okay, so like let's imagine he's going last lap crash again. in this race, or maybe second to last, whatever, the gear is thrown in the trash. He's never wearing it again. What is it, Thor? They don't sell it anymore.
I think Thor goes out of business if it happens again, and it comes back to them picking that out for him, and I think he'll have to switch to like Troy Lee. It would be that bad. Like,
yeah, new gear sponsor, the whole thing. He wins with it though.
Yep.
The gear is now framed.
Oh yeah.
And subsequently also retired. I think this gear is out of the question for him for future races, whether he had crashed or we got the outcome that we got. We shall see.
100%.
To be determined.
But you could not, it could not have been more poetic. And I think that was perfect. Just one of the coolest things. And it was one of those things where, like, I was so like zoned into the moment and watching him lap by lap and listening to the crowd. Like, the reports were at the stadium, just when he would get to certain sections, it was almost like the crowd was just in a revolutionary circle of yelling at him. Yeah. So like, he would get to the whoops, they cheer him as he goes through the whoops. He gets to the rhythm sections, that section of the stadium's going. So it's like, you didn't have to listen to the race to figure out where like AP was. You could have been like blind and just like listened. And he's like, oh, he's over here.
That's incredible.
And then of course the whole stadium gave him a standing ovation during the last lap and when he got across the finish line. And then so there was all that, and then the reporter goes, hey, isn't this what you were last year when you took a tumble? And he was like, oh yeah, yeah, it is, yeah,
yeah.
And then amidst all of this, there's a giant almost brawl going on in the background, which is so hilarious. There's so many hilarious camera shots of that too. We'll get that in a second.
Yeah.
But there was a man trying to make a charge at the old cowboy.
And a charge that was quite close a few times. Some mistakes were made. Cooper was right there on him. He had a couple opportunities, flubbed a couple. Yep. We mentioned before, we had a Chase Sexton being a lapper. You know what's interesting too is I wonder if some of these guys who are usually running up front and are not being lapped often actually have worse lapper courtesy than people who are typically being lapped, who like know the procedure of what to do, because the other guys, they're never in that scenario. You know what I mean? Like
100%.
Chase is still, and same with Eli, was there trying to, they're still trying to race, you know, because they're top guys. They want to race. They want to try to do well and finish well, even if they're down. And so they're still
right next to each other the whole race.
Yeah.
They were having a heck of a scrap for 17th when they first crashed.
Yeah. And it's not like they were going slow or anything. They were holding good speed, but yeah. I don't know. They were, yeah, it felt like they were really getting in the way of the front guys racing because they were, in fact, lappers. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's two things. One, there's all this chaos because you have Chase go down, you have Eli go down. Both of those guys went down twice. First during the opening lap and then a second time later. And those are guys that are going to work their way through the field. And then you have Ken Roczen as well. He goes down. Then he charges through the field. He goes down while AP was behind him, right? Because he, quickly talking about that, Ken Roczen was leading. And he coming into a 180 bowl turn into the first rhythm section, I believe. He was going out of that bowl turn. He was going single, then double out of it. But then Plessinger started to close the gap because he was going double and then roll over, taking an outside line on the bowl turn. And that was gaining on him. And it was setting himself up better for the next 180-degree bowl turn that directly followed. And Ken Roczen kind of figured out he was doing that, I guess, just from the fact that when he's doing a double, he's revving the engine more. So he's hearing, you know, way higher RPMs and the bike revving up in his back right ear. So he's like, oh, he's doing that. Because if he was singling, you wouldn't be hearing the bike as much on that single. So he figured out that Plessinger was going on the outside of the bowl turn, doubling, then singling out. And that's how he was catching him. So then two times, second time was when he crashed. He took that line, doubled, then singled. The second time he did it, that's when he kind of cross-rutted a little bit, and then the bike just took off to the left, nosedived. So you had – those are three really good guys that got buried for a second, had to work their way up, and were part of – two of them were really pivotal parts of the lapping situation. The second thing in regards to the lappers, and this was kind of highlighted in the 250 race that we'll break down later, where a lot of guys, but these conditions of the track – if they get passed by somebody, someone's going faster than them, once they see the, what lines the guy is taking in front of them, if they can stick around that long for just a half a lap to kind of see, oh, you can triple that, you can do this, this is a line you can take, then all of a sudden they can match their speed. That's kind of what happened with RJ when he got passed, what was it, by Kitchen? Barchbanks and then the others. He was fending them off for a while and then couldn't figure out why they were getting faster than him in certain sections. And then once they passed him, he was able to hang with them. So a lot of these lappers, not only do they want to try to stick to the leader, because then they can follow the leader as he goes and laps guys that they're fighting for position, you know? But also for just the plain fact that, you know, like Tomac all of a sudden started dropping 58 lap times, 2 seconds better than what he was doing, because of the fact that he probably saw what AP's lines were, and, you know, also didn't want to slow up too much because he's got Chase behind him and he's just going to town. So it's a weird situation when you have a mix of guys that get enlightened and see new lines that make them faster. And they also, because there's such close racing between those lappers, because of the superstars you have in these odd positions of like 10th, 11th, 12th, 17th at Malcolm. It's just a culmin of chaos. And I will say Cooper had a really good late charge. But there was two things. There was the Chase lapping situation, but I don't think it would have come to that with two laps to go or one lap to go if he didn't make that mistake on the double. I think he made a mistake on a double where he kind of went off track for just a second because of just, you know, poor timing of a landing or something like that. Just came a little short, I think. And, you know, I think he could have closed to where whenever Chase did move over for Aaron, that Cooper would have slid right through behind him. You know, he would have been that close. I don't know if he still would have got the pass done, but I think that would have taken Chase out of the equation in regards to moving over for AP and then not moving over as much for Webb. But it was weird, though, because a lot of people were giving Chase heat for not moving over for Webb after moving over for Plessinger. But when I look at the film, I mean, look, was he doing everything he possibly could to give Webb a giant hole to go through? No. But I think the reason he moved over so much for Aaron Plessinger is because at the point where he moved over for AP, where did he just pass? Well, he just passed the mechanics area where they have all the pit board signs. He probably got a giant sign from his guy saying, if you don't move over, AP's mechanic is going to throw a wrench at you while you're going 30 miles an hour. So please move over. So he goes, oh, crap. Moves over like freaking 20 yards, gives AP a huge lane to go through, but then he doesn't have that pit board communication to know what the gap behind, you know, what the gap to Webb is behind. So he's right a little more blind, you know?
So, well, they definitely didn't say, let AP through and let Cooper Webb through so he can go race AP. They didn't say that. There's not
enough room for that on the pit board. These things are, you know. Only got so much surface area, you know? I mean, heck, AP's mechanic wrote, I love you, on his pit board sign, and he barely fit that in there. He had to put the U as a straight, just the letter, after he won the race on his final lap. So the other thing was Chase took an outside line where he was supposed to double. And because of the fact that Cooper does what he loves to do towards the end of races, where all of a sudden – he'll take a really, really hard inside line because the rut has gotten so deep there. But because of the fact he was gunning it so hard coming out of that inside line, he kind of crossed over into Chase's line, causing Chase to break and not hit that double. And that's why they collided. If Cooper doesn't come over so much, Chase doesn't impede him at all. The only reason Chase really impeded him is because of the fact that Cooper took that inside line, kind of kicked himself out the rut, scooted over a little bit to the outside. Chase is coming hot off this outside line where he went all the way around the outside of the bowl turn, and he's trying to double that thing. But if he tries to double for it, he's going to take Cooper Webb's head off, like what happened to Cooper Webb at Nashville last year. So it was really just a racing incident. Yes, could Chase have, like, but, you know, once you get lapped by the first guy, like, just keep your head on a swivel for the next guy? Sure, but I don't, like, that goes back to your point of these guys that are – a lot of these guys, like Chase and Eli, getting lapped, they don't – they're not in that scenario enough to kind of – be thinking, okay, there's the lapper. The other guy's got, you know, let me look at the time board and see who's in that. Like, there's no one's going to be that aware when you're not used to being lapped to that capacity. And not to mention the conditions, all the different lines, all that, it's just wrong place, wrong time for Cooper, unfortunately, and Chase. So,
Well, speaking of passes and such and the end of the race there, we had a bit of a, like we mentioned before, kerfuffle.
A little tussle.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's great.
I think it's fantastic.
I saw you sent me the video on Twitter. I went and looked. I went and looked up Jason Anderson, see what everybody was saying. And this is getting interesting. Getting very, very interesting.
It's great. And anybody who's freaking out about it saying like, oh, we shouldn't be letting this happen in the sport. Well, too bad, because it happens all the dadgum time. It just may not always be on video for everyone to see on the NBC broadcast, because it's not always Jet Lawrence, who there isn't a camera in the stadium not trained on that guy during the entire broadcast, because they love Jet. I get it, because he brings a lot of popularity, but there's always people saying that they're really just doing too much on Jet right now, which is fair. But yeah, so basically Jet and El Hombre were having a great battle. And I honestly, both were dishing out. The main thing that, there's a case for each side to be pissed at each other. On Anderson's side, later in the race, when Jet caught up to him, they were having a great battle. And obviously, you know, I think maybe part of it was, you know, Anderson's probably still not as comfortable on his bike than Jet, because he's got a new one. Maybe later in the race, he was just getting a little bit tight. And the main thing in regards to that was we saw him in the later part of the races in the areas of the track where it truly became one line. And there, if you took that outside line, you could slip around and you definitely weren't going to pass the dude. He was taking advantage of that. He was massively slowing up. He was brake checking, you know, kind of forcing Jet to get out of rhythm, you know, kind of lose his flow to make it purposely harder for him to pass him. You know, make him uncomfortable, you know, mess with him, which to me, there's nothing illegal about that. And, you know, to the AMA, there's nothing illegal about that at all. That's just being crafty. That's being calculated. Like, that's, you know, I don't blame Anderson for that. Like,
it's not like there's zones of the track where you can't have to go a certain speed or something.
Nope.
Or anything like that. And wasn't like contact.
Nope.
Yeah. They were, from what I could tell, it was very clean battle. Like, they were,
for the most part,
just some guys being boys, you know.
Well, Jet, from Jet's side, he was pissed about Anderson brake checking and then purposely slowing down to the point where Ken Roczen caught them, and then that's when Jet finally got the move done, is he was finally able to line up a pretty last minute block pass on Anderson. It really stood him up on the bowl turn after the start finish.
That looked like the worst thing was the way that Jet passed Jason Anderson. Yeah. Which even still it wasn't that bad of a pass.
No. I mean, he didn't knock him over. He just stood him up and left him on the top of the berm. And there's nothing wrong with that. Now, but obviously Jet has his reasons for being pissed because of the fact that he slowed him down so much that Ken caught him. And then Jet didn't really have a shot at getting past where he was because of that. It may have cost Jet, you know, a better comeback ride. I don't know. The other side of it, Anderson had just as much of a right to be pissed because of the fact that, you know, Jet's response to this was taking a lot of wild lines coming out of turns to try to get past him. There was multiple times that I saw, it's all over Twitter now, but I saw one of these instances actually live on the broadcast when they showed the drone footage. You can see Jet cross jumps into Jason Anderson at least two or three times, trying to take some wild lines to set up the moves. And there was a good amount of contact, especially with one particular cross jump. They collided midair and Anderson almost, you know, fell over. So in my opinion, like, both had reasons to be pissed at each other, but I think both move on from it and don't necessarily have a big, huge fight unless Jet does what he did after the race, where he does one of these to Jason Anderson and waves him over to talk to him, and then he grabs his helmet and he's trying to lecture him like he's a veteran of the sport. And the last person you want to do this to is a guy named El Hombre, as his nickname, who then shows him how to really grab a helmet and freaking does one of these and yanks his, snaps his neck down like he's the Terminator.
And
I mean, it just went on from there. And the funniest part was this is all while Aaron Plessinger is in front of the shot celebrating and just going, "Wee!" And Hunter, Jet's brother, pulls up, sees the altercation. He's like, he like does one of these, like looks and tries to understand what's going on. And just goes and just rides away. He's like, "Nope, don't want any of that. You guys sort this out."
Yeah, no, that's no too big funny.
Coming to the rescue with El Homer. He's like, "Who's he fighting with? El Hope? Nope. I'm not getting involved with that." Now, the craziest thing was after this whole ordeal on the night of the race, you know, we get a public apology from Jet on social media. And it's like, "Hey, sorry about that. I started it. You know, it's my fault. I'll pay your fine. I shouldn't have done this whole thing," whatever. And I was like, "Oh, well, look at that. Maybe this will be owner, you know, over sooner than we thought." But it turns out that El Hombre got an apology from Jet's dad, and then Jet's social media guy, or his manager, and then he got the apology on social media, but it wasn't Jet who typed it. It could have been Jet telling him to put something out, you know, like, but it wasn't necessarily like Jet actually doing that. Jet goes and unfollows Jason Anderson on Instagram. So Jason notices that. Jason never got any kind of personal apology on the phone, over Instagram, or in person in the pits from Jet. It was just all other people apologizing for him. And then, of course, he pulls this whole unfollowing thing, whatever. So then we get to like Wednesday, and because of the fact that I saw that Jet posted that whole thing on, you know, Instagram, like saying, "I'll pay your fine. I'm sorry about this, whatever, my fault." I was like, "Oh, you know what? We're all hunky dory," but I hadn't heard from Anderson about it. But it was like, "Oh, you know what? We're good." You know, he saved his skin. He didn't want none of that smoke from El Hombre. He didn't want to get teed up in turn one next week, whatever. Well, then El Hombre on Wednesday, when I thought this whole thing was done, or Tuesday rather, goes with this bomb-breaking Instagram and Twitter post saying, "We live in a day where kids throw a fit and stand behind everyone for the media cleanup crew. Guys don't keep it real or take responsibility for themselves. I'll take full credit that I am a certain particular form of head often, but you bet I'll consistently be a, you know, for lack of a better term, a stick in the mud to you if I feel that way about you. The King won 72 races and kept it 100 till this day." When he's referencing the King, he's of course referring to Jeremy McGrath, who has the record for most amount of Supercross races won. "Jet will be amazing, but he will never be the King. 71 to go." So there's that, because, you know, there was that whole media thing about Jet was already targeting the 72 race win record before he'd even raced his rookie race. This goes on to say, he continues and says, "Okay, so first things first, my man Jet comes at me after he passes me and beat me, barks in my face. I bark back. After the race, you have his dad, Honda guy, come up and apologize. You have his agent call saying sorry, saying he will put a post on Jet's page saying sorry. Employee texts me, sorry. I didn't take it personal. Like, it, you know, whatever happens, you know, like we are cool and it didn't happen. Not a word from Jet himself. Instead, unfollow and silence from the dude everyone is apologizing for." Here's the other thing. The amount of riders in 250s, 450s, or even like, you know, just relevant names in the sport that like this message is wild.
Everybody is on Jason's side in this case, it seems.
And like, Ken Roczen just put like a LOL or a haha, like, you know, in the comments. And, you know, Ken Roczen and Jet have had some tussles before from that whole, you know, letting him through situation in SMX round two, and the whole math thing. And then Austin Faulkner randomly commented, like, he when he wrecked me a couple years ago in Dallas, which I was at that race, Jet and Austin Faulkner went to the start finish line jump, but Jet hit one of the hay bales that were on the side of the ramp going up, which putting those there is dangerous for this exact reason, because he clipped the hay bale on his way up coming out from that turn. It pushed him into Austin Faulkner's line. So they collided midair on the start finish jump, like 60 feet in the air. And then Jet almost landed it and then fell over, but he kind of fell over onto the hay bales, you know, or the tough blocks for, per se. Austin Fortner went straight down and broke his collarbone and I think maybe his leg or something like that. So apparently he was like, you know, he came up to me crying in the infirmary after the race, like, dude, get over it. That's what his comment on this whole post was, which I don't know if he's saying that he was being a wuss for like showing empathy or if he said that he was crying for like being mad about the crash and not for hurting him. I don't know how to break down Austin Fortner's reaction to the whole thing, but obviously there's a lot of riders that like that message on El Hobre's Instagram and Twitter. A lot of big names. Even Ricky Carmichael replied to him and was like, hey, here's a number, reach out to him. I was like, dude, why are you commenting a guy's number? Now you're gonna have all kinds of Jet fans, you know, reaching out. I don't know if that was
Did he really put did Ricky post Jet's number?
I don't know if it was his personal or just like the hotline number. I don't know. He just put a phone number and said call what it was weird. I don't know what the number was. I wasn't gonna try to find out, but Carmichael had a response for it, kind of playing a neutral party. It was everyone was having a party in the comment section, dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody's got to be pissed, dude. This guy keeps winning, you know?
Well, that, and he's also, you know, there's the old phrase. I remember when the Browns first got Odell, and they had Odell and Jarvis Landry, and then they lose their opening game to the Titans, and they had that one guy who just, the moment they got in the locker room, the Titans did, he was just looking for the media to just, you know, go to every possible camera. Like multiple guys got him on camera. Says, if you want to crown him, crown him. And it was just like, okay, great. That's kind of the vibe with how Jet was coming into the season of being a rookie. He is an SMX champion. He's an outdoor champion with 22-0, but Supercross is a different sport. And they were already laying down the red carpet for the dude. And, you know, it's, you know, hyping him up to be the guy who's going to break McGrath's record when we've had guys with just as much or even more hype than Jet, such as Stu and Villopoto and some other big names, Tomac at one point, come through and, you know, attempt the same thing. We're worried about how dominant they're going to be and it doesn't pan out that way. And, you know, you got 71 more to go. And, you know, he's found out how much of a grind and a meat grinder in general this 450 Supercross class is, dude. I mean, it's the same dirt bikes, same idea of racing, but it's different. It's harder to get away than in motocross when you got more room and longer lap times. So Jet messed around. And he messed around with, I think, the worst dude to mess around with because, look, there's three guys that are the professional hitmen of the 450 class. That's Vince Freeze, who doesn't discriminate. He just does it to everybody. He'll clean everyone out. Equal opportunity. You got to commend him for that. Except he does have a particular affection for cleaning out Dean Wilson. He just hates him. They got history. And then you have Justin Barsha, who's just a bull in a china cabinet. He doesn't have anyone in particular he targets, per se. It's just, if you're in my way and I care about it enough, I'm going to send you into section two. That's just how it is. And then there's, you know, El Hombre, who for the most part is kind of a, you know, contact avoidance rider until he either gets in a really, really intense moment and he'll do it to one guy for one position, you know, won't start a beef. Or if someone, you know, tries to grab the bull by the horns and tries to piss off El Hombre, he'll put you down.
Mm-hmm.
He will give you a good old dirt nap. I mean,
yeah,
many riders have messed around and found out. And tell you what, Jet's messed around. And he found out after the race, you know, when he tried to grab the helmet of a 450 champion, which is in regards to Supercross, that's not something that Jet has on his resume yet. And more importantly, a very aggressive dude once you piss him off. And he found out, I'm sure his neck's got some icy hot on it right now. And look, the other thing about El Hombre is he's not just going to get revenge on you one time. He keeps receipts, dude. He's got more receipts than a soccer mom coming out of a Marshalls. He's got all of them. You know, he's going to get you back multiple times, and he'll give you return service. Okay, this isn't going to be over in a week. It's not.
It's a multi race. Yeah, this is a multi race, multi season affair for sure.
Malcolm Stewart found that out in 2022, even though I don't think he didn't start it. Anderson crashed into him at Dallas, and then they just kept trading each race of who was going to take who out, and then it climaxed at Daytona. And then last year, Justin Barcia found out.
Mm-hmm.
The two of them just kept taking each other out, which was almost like, look at that. The two guys that are most famous for taking each other out are taking each other out, and the whole rest of the field is, you know, hunky-dory. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Jed has messed around. He will find out. I don't know if it's next race, you know, but he keeps receipts, okay? That's all I have to say.
I'm excited for it. I think it's going to be great. So speaking of Malcolm, you mentioned him here in a sec, just a minute ago. Horrible opening lap for you. I'm sitting there watching, and I see Chase and Malcolm standing off of their bikes while everybody else has begun the race. What do we make of this?
Well, you know, at the scene of the crime, you know, at the Kloppenstein household, the evidence showed a broken and thrown remote, a cup thrown on the couch, and, you know, witnesses heard the statement, "Why? Oh God, why?" And that's pretty much all there was to say about the whole thing. You know, it's terrible luck because it's the third main event that Malcolm has been in, and the third main event that he can't make it past turn one without touching the dirt and not keeping her on two. And pretty much all three times he didn't do it. Like, it wasn't necessarily his fault for causing the collision. I mean, round one freezes within the vicinity, pretty much freeze caused that. Malcolm had left him some room. Freeze came back across. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know, Freeze is involved. That's all I'm going to say. Big pileup, and it definitely wasn't Malcolm's fault. I'll say that. Round two, I mean, Anderson finds an invisible wall that he fell over, and Malcolm ran over his bike because there was nowhere to go because he just plopped over right in front of him at 20 miles an hour. So then he falls over from that. And then round three, I mean, it's just as simple as Chase cross-rutted in front of him, and that, you know, when he cross-rutted that jump, he fell down right in front of Malcolm. And also, he took out Malcolm midair. He clipped Malcolm's front wheel in midair. And that, honestly, that wreck could have been a lot worse for the both of them. They're just lucky they fell, I guess, on the right side. I don't know. So, yeah, I mean, it's just similar luck, dude. It just sucks. Because especially in pretty much all of these races, Malcolm's done okay in the heats. I mean, obviously, San Francisco, he got fifth or sixth in the heat. But it's a mutter, you know, like – it was terrible. The other one, yes, it was a mutter in San Diego, but it was, you know, you could at least do the doubles, right? So it was closer to dry than the other, and he got second and had a shot to pass Tomac on that last lap of the heat race. Almost got his first heat race win of the season. Just looking way better, you know. I mean, he looks good in his heat races. He looked good in his heat race Anaheim 1. Looked good in pretty much all of his heat races. You know the pace is there. You know, the raw speed's there. It just feels like the first three races of watching Stewart's season has been watching like a lion in a cage that he can't figure out the way out of. And, do I want to pull my hair out? Yes. Maybe that's why I'm watching the races wearing a hat, so I just throw the hat. I don't know. All I know is all of my 7 t-shirts and all of my my brand new Husqvarna jersey is now cursed. So I'm going to resort to wearing Honda merch to try to see if I can reverse the curse. To just,
okay,
you know, maybe I'm just, you know, I had a similar problem with this with wearing merch, you know, from Honda watching Sexton last season. I'm just going to see what I can do. I more importantly, just not have anything representing Malcolm while watching the races to try to just do anything I can to not put any kind of a curse on Malcolm. So, you know, Malcolm, these first three races are on me. Okay. It's the epitome of the Cowboys coming out in their navy blue uniforms. It's the same thing.
I mean, as a fan, what more can we do? You know?
Yeah. We're trying.
This is it. We change hats, we change shirts. That's about all we got.
Yeah, but look, if Malcolm gets past turn one, watch out. That's all I can say. And maybe this Anaheim 2 race is what he needs to bounce back, because if he kind of plays it like 2022 Malcolm Stewart, where he doesn't take unnecessary risks, he I will say the one fault of Malcolm Stewart, the one commonality in all three of his turn one wrecks, is he got a bad start. He consistently has had bad starts where he's between 13th and 10th or lower coming out of, you know, going into turn one. And that's how you get wrapped up with this stuff. So that's the one thing he's got to fix. He's got to get better starts so that he'll have a way better shot of getting out cleanly.
Yeah.
And that's important. So hopefully he gets better starts. And if he treats this upcoming Triple Crown at Anaheim 2 like 2022 Malcolm would, then he may have a shot for the overall. You know, just focus on getting good starts, keep it around two, continue to get top fives. You'll be in the play for the overall in that last race of the three. Don't know what's going to happen.
Love it. Any final comments on 450s?
No. I mean, honestly, that's all the chaos, dude. I will say, Craig also had a multiple big wrecks too. Craig was part of Tomac's second wreck. Craig crossroaded terribly and came over and hit Tomac midair, and that's why Tomac went down the second time. So, dude, honestly, the whole Husqvarna team, 450 and 250s, it was not a great day by any means, but especially the 450 team. Like, this is like last year's Kawasaki Pro Circuit 250 team, like with Mitch Payton level cursed. Like, obviously, everyone's still healthy, relatively speaking, but just as far as the on track outcomes, like, they got to get some sage out of that track, dude. Then, like, we need a Catholic priest with holy water to water the track. You know, regular water hoses ain't going to work no more. We got to get holy water and just bring in Oprah for moral support. Like, you know, just airdrop her in. We got to do something. Okay.
Yeah.
We've got to turn this around.
They need help. They definitely need help. It's as far as the mental battle goes, it's got to be tough where they're at right now. I would say that Aaron Plessinger has found a way to conquer the mental side of it, and he has now got confidence in himself.
And the red plate, baby.
Oh, yeah. For the first time ever, he's rocking the red plate this next weekend. It's going to be awesome. But the Husqvarna guys are in a completely opposite scenario. I think it will be a very tough place to have confidence in what you're doing with the results they're getting right now. But they gotta get back up and keep chugging. I think, like you're saying, the starts, think for both guys.
Yeah.
They can get some good starts. I think they'll be good. They've had speed. Well, I will tell you,
Craig had a good start in round two. He had a decent start on that inside line.
Wasn't he?
Yeah. Got taken out.
Yeah.
You know, I think he tipped her over and then someone ran into him. Mm. But yeah, I mean, he had a decent start in round two, but yeah, everywhere else it's been terrible. And yeah. Craig hasn't shown any kind of breakaway speed at all or consistency. He's had more wrecks than Malcolm, like, you know, in regards to outside of the first turn. He hasn't shown any kind of blazing speed in the heat races. Malcolm at least has shown good speed in the heat races.
It's
tough. That's all I could say.
Yeah. All right. Well, 250s. It's looking not exactly how I anticipated it to be. I thought RJ was going to be the clear favorite, kind of walk away with things, and out of nowhere. I mean, Jordan Smith's kind of crushing right now.
And
Levi's doing a lot better than I thought he would be on a new bike, too.
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, we've lost another guy who was kind of in the picture of Max Volin with that practice crash, hurt his hip or something like that. He's for sure out from last weekend. We don't know what his status is for the following races. It seems more like a long-term kind of deal, but we'll see. Hopefully we get it back sooner rather than later. But if he misses another round, he's out of the picture, unfortunately, which sucks because he really was looking good on that new ride. Jordan Smith, I mean – Jordan Smith is showing more of an ability to manage a championship than RJ, which we kind of knew was going to come into play. There's always the phrase RJ is going to RJ. And that happened. Now, granted, look, it's a slippery track, especially the 250 main event. The track was still a lot slipperier than what the 450 main event was. There were still plenty of guys that were struggling to do doubles. RJ did a great job leading and holding off guys, had beautiful racecraft and, you know, find a defensive lines. And you know, he was the main reason I made that comment of there was a lot of guys that once they got past, they figured out what the guy in front of them was doing different in regards to line selection and were able to hang with him. That's why when he got passed by Marchbanks and, you know, was it Kitchen at one point? I think Kitchen, maybe. He was able to pass him back at one point, and then he was trying to catch up to Marchbanks again with literally a turn to go. And I didn't even see exactly what happened, but I just know with one turn to go, that bike went cartwheeling, and you know, so did he. And he just couldn't get the bike back up in time to hang on to the podium, even though he had a considerable gap to fourth place behind him. But you know, obviously with RJ, you've got to think big picture too. Like I know you've got a shot to steal two spots and gain a lot more points, but you still got to play a conservative because you know for sure that Jordan Smith's behind you, right? So whatever you got to do to narrow that gap, if it means that you don't get a win, but you for sure close that points gap when Jordan has a bad night, great. You know, especially with the conditions, like just take your points, dude. You know, sometimes you got to know when to fold them. And, you know, it was just you know, unlucky for him. Shimoda continues to get bad starts. I mean, he got a bunch of wheel spin coming off of the main event. And I will say, with a lot of the big names that had bad starts, 450s and 250s, one of the commonalities I saw was they had a good gate pick, but they chose that inside line, like going really far inside the gate, like Malcolm. Right. Malcolm and Shimoda both had, you know, they were like gate six from the right or something like that. And basically, if you ended up getting like the actual hole shot, you were golden because there was a nice little inside rut at the start of that 180 degree turn with no banking. There was a little rut there from what was built up from the heat races. But if you did not come out ahead of your guys on the inside and outside of you there and you were anyways level or behind, you were just going to get pinched.
Yeah,
that happened to Malcolm. That's what happened to Shimoda and other guys that took that same thing. So I think with those, like with Malcolm and Shimoda, I don't think their gate pick was a wise choice. I would have taken something. I would rather have the option with this kind of lack of traction and this kind of craziness. I would rather try to make more of a sweeping motion from the outside. So that way, if I don't get the perfect start, I've got some more room to work with and I don't just get pinched off and there's just a wall of riders that I just have to wait for the pass. You know,
and worst case, you go with the Vince Freese and you just take the whole entire pack out, and then it's just you.
Yeah, because that's apparently legal. You know, it's legal.
Yeah, you take everybody out, and then you're the only one left in the race.
Yep.
Maybe they red flag it. You do it again.
Yeah. You know, you just gamble that, you know, you have a bunch more people that are like Logan Noh, who, you know, their ankle's facing the opposite direction that it should. And, you know, the more we keep knocking out, the less people lose the race. So who knows? But yeah, gate picks, I think, were a big impact in some of the starts we were seeing. So especially with Malcolm, because Malcolm, not to go back to 450s too much, but Malcolm's gate pick, I think, was just weird to take that far inside, especially when you were second in your heat race. So you get the fourth overall or third overall gate pick. I think there was a lot better places to pick from. So I don't know if he was going for an all or nothing or what, but like I know you've got an inside rut there that you can kind of lean on and get a decent launch, you know, going into that first rhythm section. But I just think it's way too much of a risk with that environment. So they both paid for it, Shimoda and Malcolm, unfortunately. Yeah, and then Garrett Marchbanks, the Muckoff team, having a good night, you know, getting a good podium out of it. And Nate Thrasher coming back from the dead, because last week we said there's two people that are absolutely not having fun right now. It was Malcolm Stewart and Nate Thrasher. Well, now one of them is having fun. The other is Malcolm Stewart. And yeah, Nate Thrasher just had a great race. Good comeback ride, you know, worked his way all the way up, you know, number one overall in the night. And it's just good to see him riding at top form again, because this is a guy that last year raced so long with a freaking torn ACL and then bruised himself up again, broke bones at Atlanta, I believe. And you know, he's a championship caliber guy. You want to see, you know, the commonality with the sport is you want to see championship caliber guys race like it, whether you like them or not. You want to see the best of the best healthy. You want to see them up front where they're supposed to be. You don't want to let the chaos of the sport leave for hypothetical, right? So it's good to see Nate insert himself into this title fight per se. He's still pretty far down in the points comparatively, but hey, getting a win is the best thing you can do to reinsert yourself into the conversation. So it's great to see.
That's first step right there. It's not going to happen unless you do that. So yeah, he's doing the right things. You want to go to our fan question, or you have some other 250 topics to discuss?
I don't know if there's much else to discuss, you know. The only other things I'd say is Juju had a bad night, just falling down all over the place. And, you know, it's another different type of traction he's having to deal with. He is a rookie. So you go from the absolute mudder to kind of muddy, kind of slick, tacky in some other areas. It's kind of like an even more – it's like an exponentially greater sense of highs and lows of traction than like the red dirt at Dallas per se. You know, that's why Dallas, those races like in the dry with that particular red dirt offer a lot of chaos, because that red dirt is tacky in some areas and then is, you know, hard packed with dust on it in others. So it gives riders false sense of security. Oh, well, in this quarter, I can just, you know, I can bowl turn it and just, you know, rail it on the outside. And I got so much traction, I can just keep it pinned, you know, and then they go over a tabletop and all of a sudden it's like ice, you know, it's basically that to a higher degree because of, you know, the way the mud was with this. And, you know, not to mention West Coast dirt, it's usually harder packed to begin with. It's a whole different thing. So, yeah, Juju had a lot to figure out. He's going to have a lot to figure out, but obviously the kid's talented. He's going to work his way back into the top, you know, top five, top six, I think, by the end of the season. And then Phil Nicoletti, Phil's not having a good time. He had a great time for the most part last week, almost had a podium, kind of was pissed he lost out on that. But look, to start off in your first three races with a did not start and a did not finish, race one and three, not good. I mean, he just had a major transmission failure during the race, and he was on the Pulp Mech show saying, hey, like, yes, I crashed before it started to go, but with the failure we had, the only thing we could have done to prevent it was change out the transmission. It was just a overall life cycle thing. Nothing we could have done about it. The wreck didn't impact it. It's just tough. He would shift down a gear and it would go into false neutral, and then it just completely quit on him eventually. And yeah, so hopefully Field to Phil bounces back next week, and we'll see what happens with that.
Which is going to be exciting, because I think that he's a guy that, you know, maybe he's not going to be in the championship fight this year, but he's definitely going to be able to be somebody who is up there, you know, making a difference in the outcomes of these races. So,
yeah, and he's just a hilarious personality.
Yeah, cool guy. You want to go to our fan question?
Yeah. Today's fan question is coming from a good friend of mine, Tyler Andrews, who is basically asking, hey, what is all this hype about this new Ducati motocross team? And all of a sudden, we have another Italian team making dirt bikes. You know, we had Beta. You know, they launched this year, and they're starting with 450 Supercross, and then eventually motocross as well, and probably the SMX series. They also started last year with the MXGP. So there's that as well. And then there's been even more hype about Triumph, you know, with them starting with 250 Supercross. So they'll be debuting their new bikes, not this weekend, but next at Détroit, Detroit.
Yeah.
And so there's all this hype, especially around Triumph. Beta has kind of been overlooked a little bit. I mean, heck, you had your manufacturer teams, you know, factory manufacturer teams graphic from Supercross, their Instagram account, and they forgot about Beta. So they put Triumph and forgot Beta. So that's an insult. And then all of a sudden we got Ducati coming into the picture, and yeah, I mean, I'm excited about it just because in general, like, yes, is having privateers in the sport cool? Yes. But that just means you have a lot of really cool guys that are pulling off miracles to make main events and then get gaffed by guys that are just on better bikes, and maybe their talent is equal or just below. And if they were on a set of equal machinery, they could compete better. Look, in Formula One, you don't have privateers. In NASCAR, there's not necessarily privateers. In IndyCar, you don't have privateers. You know, it's just whatever the gaps are, it's by the ability for the actual factory teams to make a vehicle and also the talent of the rider or driver, right? And I think for this sport to be at its, you know, best level of competition, you want more factory teams. So I'm just excited to have another one. And there's rumors that they could be trying to, you know, Ducati's got a lot of money. And even though they'd be going into their debut season in probably 2026 for Supercross, or maybe 2025 if they speed it up. Not sure which at this point. You probably have some more information on that. There's just rumors that they would be willing to just throw all the money at somebody big, like a Ken Roczen or a Jorge Prado, to get them and have them be like their franchise rider. So what have you heard in regards to Ducati's entry into the sport and for, you know, the first time making dirt bikes?
Well, so it seems like you were saying, yeah, they're not going to be coming into Supercross for another 2 years or so, or anything on the American side, because the bikes are just a prototype right now, and you have to have a homologation production bike for anything within the AMA. So they're not going to be doing that yet. They can still race over in Europe in the motocross series over there. So that's what they're going to be doing first this year. A limited number of rounds in the Italian motocross series and in MXGP. But what that tells me is they're playing the long game here, and they're making this bike, they're going to make this thing right, and it's going to be good, and it's going to be awesome. They're not going sort of like a KTM route, like it seems Triumph is doing. But what it does sound like is the bike is going to be using this special engine that they've been using, the Desmo technology or something like that, where they don't have a valve spring in the engine, and it has a much better low end, as well as that's how a lot of the Ducati bikes can rev up to like 18,000 RPM or whatever. But they also have great low end. So I think this thing could be pretty sick. We shall see.
That's going to be interesting.
Controversial topic. I think it's ugly. I do not like the way they designed the plastics whatsoever. I think it looks like trash. My least favorite.
You're saying I'm so excited. I can't wait for them to get here, but they're ugly.
Yeah. I mean, this is how I feel about it. That dude, they put, did you see the pictures where they got the exhaust and it comes right here, right? Usually
it's fully exposed. Plastics.
Yeah.
More importantly, I think they did a really, like, it's weird. I thought they were going to go with like more of a orange kind of deal, maybe. Like maybe like an orange and black kind of deal.
Yeah.
But instead they're going to do another, like a red and black kind of deal. At least from what we're seeing from their pre-production bikes for their Italian motocross stuff. So I just thought, I didn't know they were going to go with red. I always thought it'd be like black and orange or something like that. And Triumph, they're kind of doing, I don't like the look of Triumph's bike so far. It's all black and there's no contour or contrast to it. And even the shape of their number plates just kind of looks weird. I don't know. Maybe they'll unveil a different livery when it's actually go time, but I don't know. I think there's room for improvement in regards to Triumph's, you know, livery design for their bike. But I think Ducati's looks good as far as the actual paint, you know, plastic, you know, coloring and stuff like that. The side plate looks really weird though, because it's really slanted and really thin. You can hardly fit a number on there. So that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, for some reason I was anticipating red. I think it's just because when I think of, like, Ducati and Ferrari kind of live in my mind near each other. And when you think of Ferrari, you think of red sports car. And to me, when you think of Ducati, you think of red sports bike. I don't know. I think it's just me. So
I was thinking orange. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Like, I was thinking black and orange. And no, I think you're right. I honestly, you know, my second thought of what they could do is just go full Italian, full Mutabella, and just go red and green. Red, green, and white.
Yeah, well, and I also think it's like, why don't we have any other, like, there's so many other colors out there. You know, you look at F1, and it's like, we got a beautiful color palette rolling around the track. I mean, it's all kinds of stuff out there.
And except everyone started just adding in black wherever they could last season to save paint on paint, which was stupid.
But then, like, you look at motocross, and it's like, okay, basic blue, basic red, basic green, basic yellow. Privateers, they're doing whatever the hell they want because they can. Yep. But the factory teams, it's like the most basic colors. Like there's a lot of colors available, I feel like, and we're getting a lot of the same stuff.
How cool would it have been if Triumph, because this would have kind of worked more with their MO, because I think black had to be somewhere as the primary color of their livery. But imagine if like Triumph had their black bike, but with like a purple trim to it as a secondary color. It would look like, make a freaking Mace Windu bike.
You know, that would be sick. I also think that something like a green color, like how Mercedes has.
Oh yeah, do black and green. Yeah.
Would be dope. But like not more of like an aqua than like a green.
Kind of like a Cadillac green. Oh, dude, Cadillac green would look nice.
That'd be sick.
That would look nice.
Dude, or yeah. What about British Racing green?
That's basically the same thing. I mean, it's just a different, instead of more of a matte, like Cadillac green, it's usually more of a flat. It's more of a metallic. Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be sick.
Like a gloss. Oh, just.
Yeah. Anywho. Yeah.
So we can paint bikes better than these guys is what we're saying.
I haven't painted a bike. I'll give you that. However,
in Microsoft Paint, we can.
Yeah, if I do it better.
Yeah,
I would like to think so. You know what I would do? You know what we would do? We have our wives help. That's what they need to do. They need to bring their wives in when they're picking the colors. Okay, and they'll do. I mean, they'll be able to look. You know, you might have two colors next to each other. You think it's the same thing? It's not.
See, and this is what happens, you know, when men design something without running it past, you know, their wives, you know, like yeah. Men, especially when it comes to the artistic side of stuff, we can come up with beautiful ideas, right? We can come up with great things, but it's usually like our quality control is usually our wives. So usually if we draw something or paint something, it's like, it could be a good idea, but it's got to go through one or two, you know, QC, you know, quality controls, one or two vetting processes. And after, you know, usually the standard is 2 to 3, you know, hey, what are you doing? This is stupid. Try again. Sometimes it's just a flat out LOL. You get past that, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's like something like Van Gogh, man. You know,
you've got something nice. Yeah, you start out with plastics. You start with plastics that don't cover the muffler, and then you wind up with plastics that do cover the muffler.
See, okay, that's you know what? These are all just a bunch of divorce dads. You know, they don't have that vetting. You know, they don't have that person to go vet with and put this through their own quality control in-house. You know, they don't want to pay, you know, for any of their own, you know, actual artists or anything like that. So they do it themselves, but they don't have their wife to, you know, work as quality control. And that's how we get this.
Yeah. Well, and I would imagine, I mean, I don't want to harp on this muffler thing too long, but one guy falls and he gets burned on that muffler and they're going to put plastics to cover it. I would imagine that happens, and this is not a production bike, so they're not worried about getting sued right now on what takes place with the use of this bike. Something to think about. So we might end up with plastics that cover at some point. Okay. We will see. Also, a lot of people noted the different brands that were being worked with on the bike, namely Showa Suspension. So that's interesting. We'll see if that's what they stick with. Obviously, they've got options. But yeah, I do think it is quite exciting. And like I was saying, the care they're putting into this and the projections they have on how long it's going to take to get this thing, to get this program up and running, it leads me to believe that they're planning on this thing being successful. They're not just throwing something out. They're going to see how it goes. And you know, maybe they come out and don't like, I think even if they don't do well at first, they're going to continue and perfect and it's going to get better. So, I'm excited.
They're going to have troubles at the gate, especially with Supercross. I think it'll be smoother outdoors. Because Supercross is a game. You have to make a whole dedicated suspension to Supercross that is not going to be going to the production. None of your guys riding the production bikes, you know, none of your customers, you know, are going to go through whoops or, you know, go through giant rhythm lanes, you know, it's different. So I think they'll have a similar path to what Beta is kind of having right now, where they kind of got a good idea for outdoors, but when they get to Supercross, it's a whole different kind of beast, dude. You're gonna have bikes breaking down and not make it to the main event, you know. And you know, maybe you get four or five races in and you're good. I mean, you know, the one thing we left out from the 450s is that Benny Bloss finally put her in the main event, and they got a lot of all the issues sorted out with their engine they were having in the first two rounds, and you know, got a 15th overall. Not great, but look, you finally got points. So we'll be able to look back at, hey, were you there when Beta scored their first points? Yes, I was, son. I was on my couch, pissed off that Malcolm crashed in turn one for the third time in a row, but by God, Beta put her in the event.
They got points.
They got points, you know, took three rounds. There's probably other manufacturers that took longer. I don't know. We need the Twitter nerds to run some statistics on it.
Yeah. So yeah, that is quite exciting.
I think between Triumph, Beta, and Ducati, I think we get 4 or 5 years down the road with this sport, and it's just going to continue to elevate the overall quality of the races, the unpredictability, more championship threats. It's just good for the sport, and it means more people are going to get paid too. You know, more factory rides, more factory contracts. It's good for the sport. Get the best talent.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and you know, brands like Ducati have got a lot of money and a lot of time to work on this and get it done. So yeah, they're not gonna mess around. They're gonna come in and get the right guys, the right talent to make sure that it's a successful program.
Ducati, if you can hear me, you know, whatever you do, I know you're Italian. Do not hire Ferrari quality engineers. Okay. Whatever you do. I feel like this is me, like it's like that Matthew McConaughey scene from Interstellar where he's watching something happen. And he's like, "No, don't do it." And that's me screaming at anything, like with Beta, with Ducati, since they're Italian. I'm like, just don't hire anything reliability or quality control related that came from Ferrari. Okay. Yeah. I know you're Italian. I know they're willing to take a really cheap contract because he just got fired. Just don't do it. Just don't do it.
Anyway. Yeah.
All right. I think it's going to be about it for today. We kind of ran out of time to discuss fantasy stuff, but we'll discuss that next week. And appreciate you guys listening. And we'll see you guys after the very hopefully eventful Anaheim 2 Triple Crown race this weekend, the first of three. So make sure to tune in, and we'll be back here next week to break it down. So thank you all for listening, and signing off.
See you.